Welcome to Spider on the Web 23. Like all of them, this episode is being podcast under Creative Commons license, no derivatives, non-commercial, share alike. I'm going to open this week, as I did 2 weeks ago, with a tribute to Rio de Janeiro, where my darling daughter Terry Luana and her husband Jaron are now enjoying the holidays. They spent Christmas on Corcovado Beach, God bless them. I envy that kid. She's down there meeting her husband's family for the third time, and this time knows enough Portuguese, so the conversation is getting pretty good. Anyway, this is a song about the view of that beach from Cristo Redentor, the famous statue of Christ on top of the high mountain overlooking Rio. This is a song about the view from that spot by the incomparable Graham Nash and the inexplicable Jeff Pivar, whom you'll recall as one-third of the group CPR, I've been plugging heavily over the last few weeks, with occasional harmonies from David Crosby and James Raymond, bass by Leland Sklar, and drums by Russ Kunkel. Here are Graham and Jeff with Jesus of Rio.
There's an ocean between them before your eyes. Is all of humanity ready to rise up? You are standing for love in the land. There's an ocean that all can fulfill their dreams of living in freedom with all of their families. In your open arms, giving grace, holy palms, wiping their faces of tears. To see your face and your open heart, comforting all of our fears. Jesus of Rio, if everyone opened their eyes, they'd see that loving feeling is waiting. Symbol of love everlasting. Do you
devotion can lift us up to the skies with all of humanity ready to rise up.
From the album Crosby, Nash. Well, because of one particular person's desire to rise up, my wife Jeannie, I'm going to have to revise my plan this week. Last week I told you that this time I would give you a couple of book reviews, back-to-back book reviews of both the most exciting and the most disappointing science fiction novels I've read in the last several years. I do not now have time to get that together because, weird as this sounds, I never thought I'd hear myself say these words, I'm packing to go to Las Vegas. For those of you who don't know, this Friday, my best friend and wife, Jeannie, is getting a golden opportunity to experience zero gravity in a series of parabolic arcs on a modified 727, thanks to the generosity of Dr. Peter Diamandis, creator of the historic Ansari X Prize, who donated a pair of $4,000 seats to Jeannie and the dancer you can see pictured at her website, www.stardancemovie.com, Kathleen McDonough. By the way, Kathleen, we learned after Jeannie had chosen and hired her, has a kind of personal interest in the project. Her own father was a test pilot, a contemporary and cohort of the very men who were the first to go into space. He walked with men like Yeager, Glenn, Grissom, and Young. Sadly, he was one of the all too many unlucky test pilots who augured in, as they say. The right stuff can kill you just as easily as put you on the moon. Anyway, I think Kathleen feels a personal spiritual connection to this project, and if her father is still aware of events on this plane, I'm certain he'll be wearing a proud grin on Sunday. We leave Friday for Vegas, one of Zero-G Corporation's two almost spaceports, the others in Florida. Packing for a plane trip immediately after Christmas is a non-trivial task, so this week you will not be getting the double book review I spoke of last time. Hopefully it will happen next week, or the week after. For now, I'm going to substitute some more superb music and a reading from the Stardance Trilogy, the three novels that Jeannie and I wrote about, Dance and Zero Gravity, which are available in a hardcover omnibus from Bain Books. It seems apt. And it's a sneak preview for you. Blackstone Audio does now have the entire Stardance Trilogy in the can, ready to go as an audiobook. But Blackstone has so much good stuff in their catalog, the Stardance Trilogy hasn't yet been scheduled for release. So for technical reasons, what you'll hear today is not simply taken from that audiobook. Instead, I'm reading it aloud now, live. And just to prove that, I will leave in all the glitches, mispronunciations, throat clearings, farts, etc., that are normally edited out of my readings by the brilliant Rob Bailey of the Treehouse Studio here on Bowen Island, for the Blackstone audiobooks I've released so far. Without further ado, then, a very quick setup. Shara Drummond is a supremely gifted modern dancer slash choreographer, cursed with too large and obviously female a body, as her friend Charlie Armstead tells her early on. You've got tits like both halves of a prize honeydew melon, and an ass any actress in Hollywood would sell her parents for, and in modern dance that makes you D.E.D. dead, you haven't got a chance. Charlie has a similar problem. He, too, is a gifted dancer, but he has a ruined hip socket. So they try and form a company together and sell Shara's work on video, and without big company backing behind them, it dies. So Shara, somewhat to Charlie's dismay, makes her own chance. She forms an alliance with a sleazy billionaire, Grant Carrington, that will let her become the first to dance in zero gravity. She hopes that the publicity will launch her as an independent. Unfortunately, in our fictional world, people do adapt to zero gravity one way. There's a deadline, and if Shara overstays it, returning to Earth might very well kill her. And it's creeping up. We join her now just as she's completed the second zero gravity dance ever, called Mass is a Verb. What can I tell you of Mass, if you have not seen it? It cannot be described, even badly, in mechanistic terms, the way a symphony could be written out in words. Conventional dance terminology is, by its built-in assumptions, worse than useless, and if you are at all familiar with the new nomenclature, you must be familiar with Mass as a Verb, from which it draws its built-in assumptions. Nor is there much I can say about the technical aspects of Mass. There were no special effects, not even music. Raoul Brindle's superb score was composed from the dance and added to the tape with my permission 2 years later, but it was for the original silent version that I was given the Emmy. My entire contribution, aside from editing and installing the two trampolines, was to camouflage batteries of wide dispersion light sources in clusters around each camera eye and wire them so that they energized only when they were out of frame with respect to whichever camera was on at the time, ensuring that Shara was always lit from the front, presenting two not always congruent shadows. I made no attempt to employ flashy camera work. I simply recorded what she danced. No, mass is a verb can be described only in symbolic terms, and then poorly. I can say that Shara demonstrated that mass and inertia are as able as gravity to supply the dynamic conflict essential to dance. I can tell you that from them she distilled a kind of dance that could only have been imagined by a group head consisting of an acrobat, a stunt diver, a skywriter, and an underwater ballerina. I can tell you that she dismantled the last interface between herself and utter freedom of motion, subduing her body to her will and space itself to her need. And still I will have told less than nothing. For Shara sought more than freedom. She sought meaning. Mass was, above all, a spiritual event, its title pun reflecting its thematic ambiguity between the technological and the theological. Shara made the human confrontation with existence a transitive act, literally meeting God halfway. I do not mean to imply that her dance at any time addressed an exterior God, a discrete entity with or without white beard. Her dance addressed reality, gave successive expression to the three eternal questions asked by every human being who ever lived. Her dance observed herself and asked, "How have I come to be here?" Her dance observed the universe in which self existed and asked, "How did all this come to be here with me?" And at last, observing herself in relation to its universe, "Why am I so alone?" And having asked these questions with every muscle and sinew she possessed, she paused, hung suspended in the center of the sphere, her body and soul open to the universe, and when no answer came, she contracted, not in a dramatic coiling spring sense as she had in Liberation, a compressing of energy and tension. This was physically similar, but an utterly different phenomenon. It was an act of introspection, a turning of the mind's, soul's eye in upon itself to seek answers that lay nowhere else. Her body, too, therefore, seemed to fold in upon itself, compacting her mass so evenly that her position in space was not disturbed. And reaching within herself, she closed on emptiness. The camera faded out, leaving her alone, rigid, encapsulated, yearning. The dance ended, leaving her three questions unanswered, the tension of their asking unresolved. Only the expression of patient waiting on her face blunted the shocking edge of the non-ending, made it bearable, a small, blessed sign whispering, "To be continued." By the 18th day, we had it in the can, in rough form. Shara put it immediately out of her mind and began choreographing Stardance, her third, but I spent 2 hard days of editing before I was ready to release the tape for broadcast. I had 4 days until the half-hour of prime-time Carrington had purchased, but that wasn't the deadline I felt breathing down the back of my neck. Tom McGillicuddy came into my workroom while I was editing, and although he saw the tears running down my face, he said no word. I let the tape run, and he watched in silence, and soon his face was wet, too. When the tape had been over for a long time, he said very softly, "One of these days I'm going to have to quit this stinking job." I said nothing. I used to be a karate instructor. I was pretty good. I could teach again, maybe do some exhibition work, make 10% of what I do now. I said nothing. The whole damn ring's bugged, Charlie. The desk in my office can activate and tap my vidphone, any vidphone in Skyfac, 4 at a time, actually. I said nothing. I saw you both in the airlock when you came back the last time. I saw her collapse. I saw you bringing her around. I heard her make you promise not to tell Dr. Panzella. I waited. Hope stirred. He dried his face. "I came in here to tell you I was going to Panzella to tell him what I saw. He'd bully Carrington into sending her home right away." "And now," I said, "I've seen that tape. And you know that the star dance will probably kill her." "Yes." "And you know we have to let her do it." "Yes." hope died. I nodded. Then get out of here and let me work. He left. On Wall Street and aboard Skyfac, it was late afternoon when I finally had the tape edited to my satisfaction. I called Carrington, told him to expect me in half an hour, showered, shaved, dressed, and left. A major of the Space Command was there with him when I arrived, but he was not introduced, and so I ignored him. Shara was there, too, wearing a thing made of orange smoke that left her breasts bare. Carrington had obviously made her wear it as an urchin writes filthy words on an altar, but she wore it with a perverse and curious dignity that I sensed annoyed him. I looked her in the eye and smiled. "Hi, kid. It's a good tape." "Let's see," Carrington said. He and the Major took seats behind the desk, and Shara sat beside it. I fed the tape into the video rig built into the office wall, dimmed the lights, and sat across from Shara. It ran 20 minutes, uninterrupted, no soundtrack, stark naked. It was terrific. Aghast is a funny word. To make you aghast, a thing must hit you in a place you haven't armored over with cynicism yet. I seem to have been born cynical. I have been aghast 3 times that I can remember. The first was when I learned at the age of 3 that there were people who could deliberately hurt kittens. The second was when I learned at age 17 that there were people who could actually take LSD and then hurt other people for fun. The third was when mass is a verb ended and Carrington said in perfectly conversational tones, "Very pleasant, very graceful, I like it," when I learned at age 45 that there were men, not fools or cretins, but intelligent men, who could watch Shara Drummond dance and fail to see. We all, even the most cynical of us, always have some illusion which we cherish. Shara simply let it bounce off her somehow, but I could see that the Major was as aghast as I, controlling his features with a visible effort. Suddenly welcoming a distraction from my horror, I studied him more closely, wondering for the first time what he was doing here. He was my age, lean and more hard-bitten than I am, with silver fuzz on top of his skull and an extremely tidy mustache on the front. I had taken him for a crony of Carrington's, but 3 things changed my mind. Something indefinable about his eyes told me that he was a military man of long combat experience. Something equally indefinable about his carriage told me that he was on duty at the moment. And something quite definable about the line his mouth made told me that he was disgusted with the duty he had drawn. When Carrington went on, "What do you think, Major?" in polite tones, the man paused for a moment, gathering his thoughts and choosing his words. When he did speak, it was not to Carrington. "Miss Drummond," he said quietly, "I am Major William Cox, commander of SC Champion, and I am honored to meet you. That was the most profoundly moving thing I have ever seen." Shara thanked him most gravely. "This is Charles Armstead, Major Cox. He made the tape." Cox regarded me with new respect. "A magnificent job, Mr. Armstead." He stuck out his hand, and I shook it. Carrington was beginning to understand that we 3 shared a thing which excluded him. "I'm glad you enjoyed it, Major," he said with no visible trace of sincerity. "You can see it again on your television tomorrow night if you chance to be off duty, and eventually, of course, cassettes will be made available. Now perhaps we can get to the matter at hand." Cox's face closed as if it had been zippered up. "As you wish, sir." Puzzled, I began what I thought was the matter at hand. "I'd like your own comm chief to supervise the actual transmission this time, Mr. Carrington. Shara and I will be too busy to—" "My comm chief will supervise the broadcast, Armstead," Carrington interrupted, "but I don't think you'll be particularly busy." I was groggy from lack of sleep. My uptake was slow. He touched his desk delicately. "McGillicuddy, report at once," he said, and released it. "You see, Armstead, you and Shara are both returning to Earth at once."
"What? Bryce, you can't!" Shara cried. "You promised!"
"Did I? My dear, there were no witnesses present last night. Altogether for the best, don't you agree?"
I was speechless with rage. McGillicuddy entered.
"Hello, Tom," Carrington said pleasantly. "You're fired. You'll be returning to Earth at once with Miss Drummond and Mr. Armstead aboard Major Cox's vessel. Departure in 1 hour, and don't leave anything you're fond of." He glanced from McGillicuddy to me. "From Tom's desk, you can tap any vidphone in Skyfac. From my desk, you can tap Tom's desk."
Shara's voice was low. "Bryce, 2 days. Goddamn you, name your price." He smiled slightly.
"I am sorry, darling. When informed of your collapse, Dr. Panzella became most specific. Not even 1 more day. Alive, you are a distinct plus for Skyfax Image. You are my gift to the world. Dead, you are an albatross around my neck. I cannot allow you to die on my property. I anticipated that you might resist leaving, and so I spoke to a friend in the, he glanced at Cox, higher echelons of the Space Command, who was good enough to send the Major here to escort you home. You are not under arrest in the legal sense, but I assure you, you have no choice. Something like protective custody applies. Goodbye, Shara.
He reached for a stack of reports on his desk, and I surprised myself considerably. I cleared the desk entirely, tucked head catching him squarely in the sternum. His chair was bolted to the deck, and so it snapped off clean. I recovered so well that I had time for one glorious right. Do you know how if you punch a basketball squarely, it will bounce up from the floor? That's what his head did in low-G slow motion. Then Cox had hauled me to my feet and shoved me into the far corner of the room. "Don't," he said to me, and his voice must have held a lot of that habit of command they talk about because it stopped me cold. I stood breathing in great gasps while Cox helped Carrington to his feet. The multi-billionaire felt his smashed nose, examined the blood on his fingers, and looked at me with raw hatred.
"You'll never work in video again, Darmstead. You're through. Finished. Unemployed. You got that?"
Cox tapped him on the shoulder, and Carrington spun on him.
"What the hell do you want?" he barked.
Cox smiled. "Carrington, my late father once said, 'Bill, make your enemies by choice, not by accident.' Over the years, I have found that to be excellent advice. You suck."
"And not particularly well," Shara agreed.
Carrington blinked, then his absurdly broad shoulders swelled, and he roared,
"Out, all of you! Off my property at once!"
By unspoken consent, we waited for Tom, who knew his cue. "Mr. Carrington, it is a rare privilege and a great honor to have been fired by you. I shall think of it always as a Pyrrhic defeat." And he half-bowed, and we left, each buoyed by a juvenile feeling of triumph that must have lasted 10 seconds. The sensation of falling that you get when you first enter zero-G is literal truth, but it fades rapidly as your body learns to treat it as an illusion. Now, in zero-G, for the last time, for the half hour or so before I would be back in Earth's gravitational field, I felt like I was falling, plummeting into some bottomless gravity well dragged down by the anvil that was my heart, the scraps of a dream that should have held me aloft fluttering overhead. A guard at the airlock saluted as we entered. Cox led us aft to the compartment where we were to strap in. He noticed along the way that I used only my left hand to pull myself along, and when we stopped he said, "Mr. Armstead, my late father also told me, hit the soft parts with your hand, hit the hard parts with a utensil. Otherwise I can find no fault with your technique. I wish I could shake your hand." I tried to smile, but I didn't have it in me.
"I admire your taste in enemies, Major. A man can't ask for more. I'm afraid I can't spare time to have your hand looked at until we've grounded. We begin re-entry immediately."
"Forget it. Get Shara down fast and easy."
He bowed to Shara, did not tell her how deeply sorry he was to etc., wished us all a comfortable journey, and left. We strapped into our acceleration couches to await ignition. There ensued a long and heavy silence, compounded of a mutual sadness that bravado could only have underlined. We did not look at each other, as though our combined sorrow might achieve some kind of critical mass. Grief struck us dumb, and I believe that remarkably little of it was self-pity. But then a whole lot of time seemed to have gone by. Quite a bit of intercom chatter came faintly from the next compartment, but ours was not in circuit. At last we began to talk, desultorily, discussing the probable critical reaction to mass as a verb, whether analysis was worthwhile or the theater really dead, anything at all except future plans. Eventually there was nothing else to talk about, so we shut up again. I guess I'd say we were in shock. For some reason I came out of it first.
"What the hell is taking them so long?"
I barked irritably. Tom started to say something soothing, then glanced at his watch and yelped.
"You're right! It's been over an hour!"
I looked at the wall clock, got hopelessly confused until I realized it was on Greenwich time rather than Wall Street, and realized he was correct.
"Christ sakes," I shouted. "The whole bloody point of this exercise is to protect Shara from overexposure to free fall. I'm going forward."
"Charlie, hold it." Tom, with two good hands, unstrapped faster than I. "Damn it, stay right there and cool off. I'll go find out what the holdup is." He was back in a few minutes, and his face was slack. "We're not going anywhere. Cox has orders to sit tight."
"What? Tom, what the hell are you talking about?"
His voice was all funny. "Red fireflies. More like bees, actually.
in a balloon. He simply could not be joking, which meant he flat out had to have gone completely round the bend, which meant that somehow I had blundered into my favorite nightmare, where everybody but me goes crazy and begins gibbering at me. So I lowered my head like an enraged bull and charged out of the room so fast the door barely had time to get out of my way. It just got worse. When I reached the door to the bridge, I was going much too fast to be stopped by anything short of a body block, and the crewmen present were caught flat-footed. There was a brief flurry at the door, and then I was on the bridge, and then I decided that I had gone crazy, too, which somehow made everything all right. The forward wall of the bridge was one enormous video tank, and just enough off-center to faintly irritate me. Standing out against the black deep as clearly as cigarettes in a dark room, there truly did swarm a multitude of red fireflies. The conviction of unreality made it okay. But then Cox snapped me back to reality with a bellowed, "Off this bridge, mister!" If I'd been in a normal frame of mind, it would have blown me out the door and into the farthest corner of the ship. In my current state, it managed to jolt me into acceptance of the impossible situation. I shivered like a wet dog and turned to him. "Major," I said desperately, "what is going on?" As a king may be amused by an insolent varlet who refuses to kneel, he was bemused by the phenomenon of someone failing to obey him. It bought me an answer. "We are confronting intelligent alien life," he said concisely. "I believe them to be sentient plasmoids." I had never for a moment believed that the mysterious object which had been leapfrogging around the solar system since I came to Skyfac was alive. I tried to take it in, then abandoned the task and went back to my main priority. "Well, I don't care if they're 8 tiny reindeer. You've got to get this can back to Earth now." "Sir, this vessel is on emergency red alert and on combat standby. At this moment, the suppers of everyone in North America are getting cold unnoticed. I will consider myself fortunate if I ever see Earth again. Now get off my bridge." "But you don't understand. Shara's right on the edge. Farting around like this will kill her. That's what you came up here to prevent, damn it." "Mr. Armstead, this is a military vessel. We are facing more than 50 intelligent beings who appeared out of hyperspace near here 20 minutes ago, beings who therefore use a drive beyond my conception with no visible parts. If it makes you feel any better, I am aware that I have a passenger aboard of greater intrinsic value to my species than this ship and everyone else aboard her, and if it is any comfort to you, this knowledge already provides a distraction I need like an auxiliary anus, and I can no more leave this orbit than I can grow horns. Now will you get off this bridge, or will you be dragged?"
I didn't get a chance to decide. They dragged me. On the other hand, by the time I got back to our compartment, Cox had put our vidphone screen in circuit with the tank on the bridge. Shara and Tom were studying it with rapt attention. Having nothing better to do, I did too. Tom had been right. They did act more like bees in the swarming rapidity of their movement. I couldn't get an accurate count, about 50. And they were in a balloon, a faint, barely visible thing on the fine line between transparency and translucence. Though they darted like furious red gnats, it was only within the confines of the spheroid balloon. They never left it or seemed to touch its inner surface. As I watched, the last of the adrenaline rinsed out of my kidneys, but it left a sense of frustrated urgency. I tried to grapple with the fact that these Space Commando special effects represented something that was more important than Shara. It was a primevally disturbing notion, but I could not reject it. In my mind were two voices, each hollering questions at the top of their lungs, each ignoring the other's questions. One yelled, "Are those things friendly or hostile, or do they even use those concepts? How big are they? How far away? From where?" The other voice was less ambitious, but just as loud. All it said over and over again was, "How much longer can Shara remain in free fall without dooming herself?" Shara's voice was full of wonder. They're dancing." I looked closer. If there was a pattern to the flies on garbage swarm they made, I couldn't detect it.
"Looked random to me."
"Charlie, look. All that furious activity, and they never bump into each other or the walls of that envelope they're in. They must be in orbits as carefully choreographed as those of electrons."
"Do atoms dance?"
She gave me an odd look. "Don't they, Charlie?"
"Laser beam," Tom said. We looked at him. "Those things have to be plasmoids. The man I talked to said they show on deep space radar. That means they're ionized gases of some kind, the kind of thing that used to cause UFO reports." He giggled and then caught himself. "Well, if you could slice through that envelope with a laser, I'll bet you could deionize them pretty good. Besides, that envelope has to hold their life support, whatever it is they metabolize."
I was dizzy. "Then we're not defenseless?"
You're both talking like soldiers, Shara burst out. I tell you, they're dancing. Dancers aren't fighters.
Oh, come on, Sharon, I barked. Even if those things happen to be remotely like us, that's not true. Tai Chi, karate, kung fu, they're dance. I nodded to the screen. All we know about these animated embers is that they travel interstellar space. That's enough to scare me.
Charlie, look at them, she commanded.
I did. By God, they didn't look threatening, and they did. The more I watched, seemed to move in a dance-like way, whirling and mad adagios just too fast for the eye to follow. Not at all like conventional dance, more analogous to what Shara had begun with masses of verb. I found myself wanting to switch to another camera for contrast of perspective, and that made my mind start to wake up at last. Two ideas surfaced, the second one necessary in order to sell Cox the first.
"How far do you suppose we are from Skyfac?" I asked Tom.
He pursed his lips. "Not far. There hasn't been much more than maneuvering acceleration.
The damn things were probably attracted to Skyfac in the first place. It must be the most easily visible sign of intelligent life in this system. Maybe they don't use planets."
I reached forward and punched the audio circuit.
"Major Cox, get off this circuit.
How would you like a closer view of those things?"
"We're staying put. Now stop jiggling my elbow and get off this circuit, or I'll..."
"Will you listen to me? I have 4 mobile cameras in space. Remote control, self-contained power and light, and better resolution than you've got. They were set up to tape Shara's next dance."
He shifted gears at once.
"Can you patch them into my ship?"
"I think so, but I'll have to get back to the master board in Ring 1.
"No good, then. I can't tie myself to a top. What if I have to fight or run?
Major, how far a walk is it?"
It startled him a bit.
"Well, couple of kilometers as the crow flies, but you're a ground lubber."
"I've been in free fall for most of 2 months. Give me a portable radar and I can ground on Phobos."
"You're a civilian, but damn it, I need better video. Permission granted."
"Now for the first idea." "Wait, one thing more. Shara and Tom must come with me."
"Nuts, this isn't a field trip."
"Major Cox, Shara must return to a gravity field as quickly as possible. Ring 1 will do. In fact, it'd be ideal if we enter through the spoke in the center. She could descend very slowly and acclimatize gradually, the way a diver decompresses, in stages, but in reverse. Tom will have to come along and stay with her. If she passes out and falls down the tube, she could break a leg even in 1/6 G. Besides, he's better at EVA than either of us."
He thought it over. "Go."
We went. The trip back to Ring 1 was longer than any Shara or I had ever made, but under Tom's guidance we made it with minimal maneuvering. Ring, Champion, and Aliens formed an equiangular triangle about 5 or 6 clicks on a side. Seen in perspective, the aliens took up about twice as much volume as a sphere the diameter of Ring 1, one hell of a big balloon. They did not pause or slacken in their mad gyration, but somehow they seemed to watch us cross the gap to Skyfac. I got the impression of a biologist studying the strange antics of a new species. We kept our suit radios off to avoid distraction, and it made me just a little more susceptible to suggestion. I failed to even notice the absence of any local vertical. I was too busy. I left Tom with Shara and dropped down the tube 6 rungs at a time. Carrington was waiting for me in the reception room with 2 flunkies. It was plain to see that he was scared silly and trying to cover it with anger.
"God damn it, Armstead, those are my bloody cameras."
"Shut up, Carrington. If you put those cameras in the hands of the best technician available, me, and if I put their data in the hands of the best strategic mind in space, Cox, we might be able to save your damn factory for you and the human race for the rest of us." I moved forward and he got out of my way. It figured. Putting all humanity in danger just might be bad PR. After all the practicing I'd done, it wasn't hard to direct 4 mobile cameras through space simultaneously by eye. The aliens ignored their approach. The Skyfac comm crew fed my signals to the Champion and patched me into Cox on audio. At his direction, I bracketed the balloon with the cameras, shifting POV at his command. Space Command headquarters must have recorded the video, but I couldn't hear their conversation with Cox, for which I was grateful. I gave him slow-motion replay, close-ups, split-screens, everything at my disposal. The movements of individual fireflies did not appear particularly symmetrical, but patterns began to repeat. In slow motion, they looked more than ever as though they were dancing, and although I couldn't be sure, it seemed to me that they were increasing their tempo. Somehow, the dramatic tension of their dance began to build. And then I shifted POV to the camera which included Skyfac in the background, and my heart turned to hard vacuum, and I screamed in pure primal terror, halfway between Ring 1 and the swarm of aliens. Coming up on them slowly but inexorably was a pea-suited figure. That had to be Shara. With theatrical timing, Tom appeared in the doorway beside me, leaning heavily on Harry Stein, his face drawn with pain. He stood on 1 foot, the other plainly broken.
I guess I can't go back to exhibition work after all, he said. She said, I'm sorry, Tom. I knew she was going to swing on me. She wiped me out anyhow. Oh, damn it, Tarly, I'm sorry. He sank into an empty chair. Cox's voice came urgently.
What in hell is going on? Who is that?
She had to be on our frequency.
Shara! I screamed. Get your ass back in here!
I can't, Charlie. Her voice was startlingly loud and very calm. Halfway down the tube, my chest started to hurt like hell.
Ms. Drummond, Cox rapped, if you approach any closer to the aliens, I will destroy you.
She laughed, a merry sound that froze my blood. Bullshit, Major. You aren't about to get gay with laser beams near those things. Besides, you need me as much as you do Charlie.
What do you mean?
These creatures communicate by dance. It's their equivalent of speech, a sophisticated kind of sign language, like hula.
You can't know that.
I feel it. I know it. Hell, how else do you communicate in airless space? Major Cox, I am the only qualified interpreter the human race has at the moment. Now, will you kindly shut up so I can try to learn their language?
I have no authority to...
I said an extraordinary thing. I should have been gibbering, pleading with Shara to come back, maybe even racing for a pea suit to bring her back. Instead, I said, she's right. Shut up, Cox.
But,
damn you, don't waste her last effort. He shut up. Penzella came in, shot Tom full of painkiller, and set his ankle right there, but I was oblivious. For over an hour, I watched Shara watch the aliens. I watched them myself in the silence of utter despair, and for the life of me, I could not follow their dance. I strained my mind, trying to suck meaning from their crazy whirling, and failed. The best I could do to aid Shara was to record everything that happened for a hypothetical posterity. Several times she cried out softly, small, muffled exclamations, and I ached to call out to her in reply, but did not. With the last exclamation, she used her thrusters to bring her closer to the alien swarm and hung there for a long time. At last her voice came over the speaker, thick and slurred at first, as though she were talking in her sleep. God, Charlie, strange. So strange. I'm beginning to read them.
How?
Every time I begin to understand a part of the dance, it brings us closer. Not telepathy, exactly. I just know them better. Maybe it is telepathy, I don't know. By dancing what they feel, they give it enough intensity to make me understand. I'm getting about one concept in three, I think. It's stronger up close.
Cox's voice was gentle but firm. What have you learned, Shara?
That Tom and Charlie were right. They are warlike. At least there's a flavor of arrogance to them, a conviction of superiority. Their dances are challenging, a dare. Tell Tom I think they do use planets.
What?
I think at one stage of their development they're corporeal, planet-bound. Then when they've matured sufficiently, they become these fireflies and head out into space.
Why?
From Cox. To find spawning grounds, I think. They want Earth. There was a silence lasting perhaps 10 seconds. Then Cox spoke up quietly. Back away, Shara. I'm going to see what lasers will do to them.
No!
She cried, loud enough to make a really first-rate speaker distort.
Shara, as Charlie pointed out to me, you are not only expendable, you are, for all practical purposes, expended.
No!
This time it was me shouting. Major, Shara said urgently, that's not the way. Believe me, they can dodge or withstand anything you or Earth can throw at them. I know.
Hell and damnation, woman, Cox said. What do you want me to do? Let them have the first shot? There are vessels from 4 countries on their way right now, and they won't...
Major, wait. Give me time. He began to swear, then cut off.
How much time?
She made no direct reply. If only this telepathy thing works in reverse. It must. I'm no more strange to them than they are to me. Probably less so. I get the idea they've been around. Charlie?
Yeah?
This is a take. I knew. I had known since I first saw her in open space on my monitor. And I knew what she needed now from the faint trembling of her voice. It took everything I had, and I was only glad I had it to give. With extremely realistic good cheer, I said, "Break a leg, kid," and killed my mic before she could hear the sob that followed. And she danced. It began slowly, the equivalent of one-finger exercises, as she sought to establish a vocabulary of motion that the creatures could comprehend. "Can you see," she seemed to say, "that this movement is a reaching, a yearning? Do you see that this is a spurning, this an unfolding, that a graduated elision of energy? Do you feel the ambiguity in the way I distort this arabesque, or that the tension can be resolved so? And it seemed that Shara was right, that they had infinitely more experience with disparate cultures than we, for they were superb linguists of motion. It occurred to me later that perhaps they had selected motion for communication because of its very universality. Man danced before he spoke. At any rate, as Shara's dance began to build, their own began to slow down perceptibly in speed and intensity, until at last they hung motionless in space, watching her. Soon after that, Shara must have decided that she had sufficiently defined her terms, at least well enough for pigeon communication, for now she began to dance in earnest. Before, she had used only her own muscles and the shifting masses of her limbs. Now she added thrusters, singly and in combination, moving within as well as in space. Her dance became a true dance, more than a collection of motions, a thing of substance and meaning. It was unquestionably the star dance, just as she had pre-choreographed it, as she had always intended to dance it. That it had something to say to utterly alien creatures of man and his nature was not at all a coincidence. It was the essential and ultimate statement of the greatest artist of her age, and it had something to say to God himself. The camera light struck silver from her pea suit, gold from the twin air tanks on her shoulders. To and fro against the black backdrop of space she wove the intricacies of her dance, a leisurely movement that seemed somehow to leave echoes behind it, and the meaning of those great loops and whirls became clear, drying my throat and clamping my teeth. For her dance spoke of nothing more and nothing less than the tragedy of being alive and being human. It spoke most eloquently of despair. It spoke of the cruel humor of limitless ambition yoked to limited ability, of eternal hope invested in an ephemeral lifetime, of the driving need to try to create an inexorably predetermined future. It spoke of fear and of hunger, and most clearly of the basic loneliness and alienation of the human animal. It described the universe through the eyes of man, a hostile embodiment of entropy into which we are all thrown alone, forbidden by our nature to touch another mind save second hand, by proxy. It spoke of the blind perversity which forces man to strive hugely for a peace which, once attained, becomes boredom. And it spoke of folly, of the terrible paradox by which man is capable simultaneously of reason and unreason, forever unable to cooperate even with himself. It spoke of Shara and her life. Again and again cyclical statements of hope began, only to collapse into confusion and ruin. Again and again cascades of energy strove for resolution and found only frustration. All at once she launched into a pattern that seemed familiar, and in moments I recognized it, the closing movement of mass as a verb recapitulated, not repeated but reprised, echoed, the three questions given a more terrible urgency by this new context. And as before, it segued into that final relentless contraction, that ultimate drawing inward of all energies. Her body became derelict, abandoned, drifting in space, the essence of her being withdrawn to her center and invisible. The quiescent alien stirred for the first time. And suddenly she exploded, blossoming from her contraction not as a spring uncoils, but as a flower bursts from a seed. The force of her release flung her through the void as though she were tossed like a gull in a hurricane by galactic winds. Her center appeared to hurl itself through space and time, yanking her body into a new dance. And the new dance said, "This is what it means to be human, to see the essential existential futility of all action, all striving, and to act, to strive. This is what it is to be human, to reach forever beyond your grasp. This is what it is to be human, to live forever or die trying. This is what it is to be human, to perpetually ask the unanswerable questions in the hope that the asking of them will somehow hasten the day when they will be answered. This is what it is to be human, to strive in the face of the certainty of failure. This is what it is to be human, to persist." It said all this with a soaring series of cyclical movements that held all the rolling majesty of grand symphony, as uniquely different from each other as snowflakes and as similar. And the new dance laughed as much at tomorrow as at yesterday, and most of all at today. "For this is what it means to be human, to laugh at what another would call tragedy." The alien seemed to recoil from the ferocious energy, startled, awed, and perhaps a little frightened by Shara's indomitable spirit. They seemed to wait for her dance to wane, for her to exhaust herself, and her laughter sounded on my speaker as she redoubled her efforts, became a pinwheel, a Catherine wheel. She changed the focus of her dance, began to dance around them now in pyrotechnic spatters of motion that came ever closer to the intangible spheroid which contained them. They cringed inward from her, huddling together in the center of the envelope, not so much physically threatened as cowed. "This," said her body, "is what it means to be human. To commit harakiri with a smile, if it becomes needful." And before that terrible assurance, the aliens broke. Without warning, fireflies and balloon vanished, gone elsewhere. I know that Cox and Tom were still alive, because I saw them afterwards, and that means they were probably saying and doing things in my hearing and presence, but I neither heard them nor saw them then. They were as dead to me as everything except Shara. I called out her name, and she approached the camera that was lit until I could make out her face behind the plastic hood of her pea-suit. "We may be puny, Charlie," she puffed, gasping for breath, "but by Jesus, we're tough." "Shara, come on in now." "You know I can't. Carrington will have to give you a free-fall place to live now." "A life of exile? For what? To dance? Charlie, I haven't got any more to say." "Well, then I'll come out there." "Don't be silly. Why? So you can hug a pressure suit, tenderly bump hoods one last time?" "Balls. It's a good exit so far. Let's not blow it." "Shara!" I broke completely, just caved in on myself and collapsed into great racking sobs. "Charlie, listen now," she said softly, but with an urgency that reached me even in my despair. "Listen now, for I haven't much time. I have something to give you. I hoped you'd find it for yourself, but will you listen?"
"Yes."
"Charlie, zero-G dance is going to get awful popular all of a sudden. I've opened the door. But you know how fads are. They'll bitch it all up unless you move fast. I'm leaving it in your hands."
"What are you talking about?"
"About you, Charlie. You're going to dance again."
Oxygen starvation, I thought, but she can't be that low on air already. "Okay, sure thing."
"For God's sake, stop humoring me. I'm straight, I tell you. You'd have seen it yourself if you weren't so damn stupid. Don't you understand? There's nothing wrong with your leg in free fall."
My jaw dropped.
"Do you hear me, Charlie? You can dance again."
"No," I said, and searched for a reason why not.
"You can't. It's, damn it, the leg's not strong enough for inside work." "Forget for the moment that inside work will be less than half of what you do. Forget it. Remember that smack in the nose you gave Carrington? Charlie, when you leaped over the desk, you pushed off with your right leg."
I sputtered a while and shut up.
"There you go, Charlie, my farewell gift. You know I've never been in love with you, but you must know that I've always loved you. Still do."
"I love you, Shara."
"So long, Charlie. Do it right."
And all four thrusters went off at once. I watched her go down. A while after she was too far to see, there was a long golden flame that arced above the face of the globe, waned, and then flared again as the air tanks went up.
Well, that takes you as far as page 67 of the Stardance trilogy. That much, the original Stardance novella, was enough to win Jeannie and me the Hugo Award for Best Novella in 1977. But as you probably noticed, we had left several major questions unanswered, such as who the hell are those aliens, where the hell are they from, why did they come here, and in particular, why did they happen to pick just now? The answers turn out to require another 405 pages result in one of the most audacious endings I ever attempted until I got to Variable Star. It is to be hoped that sometime soon Bain Books will get around to scheduling the paperback edition. In the meanwhile, the Stardance trilogy is available in hardcover in a single volume. As I said earlier, to learn more about the IMAX movie Jeannie's trying to get made of Zero Gravity Dance, go to www.stardancemovie.com and note that there's now a blog button, in consequence of which I'm going to do something I swore mighty oaths I would never do,
Between now and the time we get back home, I am going to blog, because so many of you have written us letters, emails, and given us phone calls expressing interest in this and wanting to know how it's going on, and we figure we give you an up-to-date, live, roughly daily blog. Look to see you there. Now for a complete change of subject. Longtime fans of the great folk singer Janis Ian know her as a Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter, and you all probably are aware that her debut song, Society's Child, written when she was 14 years old, mind you, was inducted into the Grammy Hall of Fame a couple years ago. Well, more hot news, she's done it again. One of her follow-ups, a song that used to be memorized by every single female alive, called At 17, has also been inducted into the Grammy Hall of Fame. And because there is a rising generation of young women who have not heard 17, many of whom badly need to, I really wish I could play it for you here. Unfortunately, this goes so far back in Janis's career that I don't know if we can clear the rights for it. So instead, I'm going to play you something more modern. I ought to play you something from her most recent album, the title I just love, Folk is the New Black. Or I could play something from God and the FBI, its predecessor. There's some amazing music on both of those. I'm just going to send you to janisian.com for a list of all her wonderful records and play you one track that has particular meaning to me. Some years back, about 3 or 4 years ago, I guess, Janis sent out a missive to all the science fiction writers she could get addresses for. Janis Ian, be it known, is a closet science fiction fan. So she wrote to me and several others explaining that and saying that she wanted to put together an anthology called Stars, of science fiction stories inspired by Janis Ian songs. Would I by any chance be interested in receiving her entire recorded lifetime output for inspiration? I've been a Janis Ian fan since Society's Child. I leaped on it to complete my collection, and in short order, tons and tons of CDs came in the house, and into the houses of pretty much a who's who of science fiction. David Gerald, Terry Bisson, Orson Scott Card, John Varley, Robert J. Sawyer, Susan Matthews, Howard Waldrop, the Harry Turtledove, the list just goes on and on. Pretty much everybody in the business, Cage Baker, got the call, and it was astonishing how many of them turned out to be closet Janis Ian fans. All of us leaped on her work, and as fast as we staked out a story and felt inspired by it, we would tell everybody else, hands off that one. And the one I chose almost instantly, you're about to hear. It's a very simple, very spare little song. I think of it as the perfect song for a gay person to sing to a homophobe, because it says everything that person should be told and doesn't contain a single particle of anger. Just a simple truth that ought to be enough. You don't know my heart.
Learn to stand in the shadows, watch the way the wind blows, thinking that no one knows we're one of a kind. Shy glances at the neighbor's team, romance is a dangerous dream. Never knowing if they'll laugh or scream, living on a fault line. Will you, won't you be mine? Hoping it'll change in time. We can hold hands when there's sunlight in the park. We just hold hands after dark. And if people say we choose this way to set ourselves apart, I say, you don't know my heart. You don't know my heart. I used to run, I used to hide. Heard a joke and let it slide. Easier to laugh. Waiting on discovery. Tried to fit, I tried to blend. I learned young to pretend. if they knew the world would end, frightened of my family. Where is anyone like me? When will I be free? We can't hold hands when it's sunlight in the park. We just hold hands after dark. And when people say we choose this way to set ourselves apart, I say, you don't know my heart. You don't know my heart. Everybody needs a love of their own. I'm no different than the rest. Everyone deserves a happy home, and that's what we do best. Why do they have to make it a test? We can't hold hands when it's sunlight in the park. We just hold hands after dark. And if people say we choose this way to set ourselves apart, I say, you don't know my heart. You don't know my heart. Can't hold hands when it's sunlight in the park. We just hold hands after dark.
While I'll say that I'm reasonably proud of the story I produced, inspired by that song that's found in Stars, I have to say that I was barely keeping up with the band. I mean, I'm telling you, this book is a huge volume full of most of the great writers working in the field at the time. A few of them couldn't make it, but almost everybody did, and they all brought their best game. I mean, you know, one of the best John Varley stories I ever read is found in this anthology. The same with David Gerrold's story, Writing Janice. I wish there were a Robert Sheckley in here. Robert Sawyer has a story called Immortality that's just top form for him. It's that way all the way through. Everybody brought their best game and produced astonishing work. It happened that the anthology was launched at the World Science Fiction Convention when it was held in Canada, in Toronto, the very same one at which I was given the commission to write Variable Star. And I'm happy to say that Janice took advantage of our more humane legal structure to marry her significant other of umpty-ump years, and she went home with a big smile on her face. But check this anthology out. It is science fiction as fine as it gets. I was frankly astonished when it didn't sweep the Hugo nominations that year. It really should have. Editor Mike Resnick has an awful lot to be proud of. He did a superb job of eliciting great work from friends and colleagues. And if you want to read some of the best science fiction written in that or any year, look for Stars by Janice and Mike Resnick. A good time is guaranteed. Over the weekend, don't forget to check the blog at stardancemovie.com. And I'll be back next week, I hope, with what I promised you this week, the story of both the best and the most disappointing science fiction novels I've read in years. Till then, this is Spider on the Web, signing off.